Every drug has a dark side. It doesn't matter if you're taking just enough of the drug. Once you're over that minimum toxic concentration, the risk of more severe adverse effects also increases.
FDA says the drugs could cause severe breathing problems or even death. The medication is used to treat pain caused by seizures.
The idea, the goal is to keep the patient or yourself in the golden zone, right?
Yeah, this is why a lot of times we got to take these drugs with regimented doses.
It really emphasizes how important it is to follow the instructions of your physician whenever you're taking these medications.
Welcome to the very first episode of our podcast, The CortiCare Podcast. Today, we're learning and talking about seizure medications, where we dive into one of the most critical aspects of epilepsy management. Not understanding seizure medications can be dangerous, not only for those taking them, but also for their loved ones. Proper knowledge can mean the difference between effective seizure control and a crisis. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by Mr. Jay Jones, an EEG specialist, an IOM specialist, and a neurodiagnostic educator. He's an absolute wealth of knowledge when it comes to seizure medications and epilepsy management. Over the next 20 minutes, we'll tap into his expertise to bring you the basics, Seizure Medication 101. And since this is the first in a series of episodes with Mr. Jones, we'll be starting from the ground up to give you a solid foundation before diving into more complex topics in future episodes. Whether you're a patient, a caregiver, or a healthcare professional, this series is packed with valuable information to help you better understand seizure medications and their crucial role in epilepsy management. So let's get started.
But let's dive into names.
Okay.
Because, you know, when I started studying for my boards, I didn't realize how many names there are and what those actually mean. So can you give me a little bit of, you know, how names are generated, what they mean, and just kind of an overview of what that is.
Right. So names are a very important thing. Come from someone who only has one letter as a name. They're really big. So when it comes to naming, drugs have three names. Okay. They have the name that is a chemical name that's going to describe the molecule. And then they have their generic name, and then they have their trade name, which is the branded trademark name that is sold on store shelves. So the chemical name is always going to be just something that describes a molecule, like isobutylphenylpropionic acid, which is ibuprofen. Ibuprofen is a generic name because it's a lot easier to say that. And then they'll market that as something like Motrin or any of the other numerous ibuprofens that are on the shelf.
So are these names proprietary to one specific drug?
That's a great question. So the chemical names, they're not going to be proprietary. Anyone can use them, and the generic names as well. In fact, when you see generic drugs go on store shelves, like ibuprofen, for example, or maybe acetaminophen, these drugs are the generic names, and they're free for everybody. But things like Motrin, Tylenol, these drugs are going to be the trademarked proprietary names that the companies use.
These are names that the marketer came up with. Like, right. Hey, what's a cool name for this unpronounceable molecular name drug?
Yeah, another great Tylenol. Example of that would be Keppra. No one's going to have a great or fun time saying levetiracetam,
levetiracetam,
right.
Levetiracetam.
So it's way easier to just say Keppra.
Yeah. I mean, Reviac. That's smart because Keppra is an easy name to remember, and I guess that's a whole purpose.
Right. And part of that, though, can cause some confusion because when you have drugs like lamotrigine and Lamictal, and you have two different patients, one's on the generic because their insurance might not cover the trade name version, and the other one is on the trade name version, they might think that there's two different drugs. Yeah. Or even just the same patient, they might switch over to a new insurance, be able to get the trade name or have to get the generic name. And then they think they're taking a different drug, and it causes some confusion. It might even interfere with treatment.
So are there different brand names for Lamotrigine, Lamictal, or is it just one name for each one? I mean, I guess it's however many companies are making these drugs.
That's exactly it. It kind of depends on how many companies are making it. Regarding Lamictal amitriptyline specifically, I'm not sure of any other trade names for it, but let's use Depakote, for example. Depakote can be Depakote or it can be Depakine. And I believe there's at least one other name for it too. And those are just the trade names.
That's confusing because if you're a patient and you are prescribed Depakote and you're not, just like you said, if you go to another doctor or you go to another insurance and then they say, well, you need Depakine, it doesn't process. It might not process to you if you're not in the healthcare industry that these are two of the same molecular drugs. Like they're the same drugs molecularly, but they're not the same drugs as far as who makes them.
Right.
Is there a big difference between brands or do you think it's, I mean, if it's molecular, obviously, it's going to be really close, right? Or is there subtle differences?
Well, when it comes to the active ingredient, they have to be the same drug.
Okay.
And dosing and percentage of the active ingredient has to be labeled. So that's got to be the same. But all the other ingredients that go into making it, like let's say we're talking about a pill here, we have other things that go into it. The glue, so to speak, that holds the pill together or the plastic around a tablet may be different. Those are the things that a company can change up on their formulas in order to make it more profitable or cheaper to make or whatnot.
But that doesn't change the efficacy of the drug. Hopefully not, right? Or it shouldn't probably.
Hopefully not.
Yeah.
There's some rare examples of drugs that may not be as effective for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's just has to do with those other inactive ingredients. For example, some drugs might start to break down in the stomach a little sooner than their trade name version or than a different version of it. Or in the case of ibuprofen, one of my favorites to keep going back to because it's just easy and common, ibuprofen may have a coated version of the tablet when it's sold under Motrin, and that coating prevents it from breaking down in your stomach. And so it can be absorbed where it needs to be absorbed later down the line. Whereas a non-coated generic will start breaking down earlier, and that can lead to some of the adverse effects like ulcers, stomach bleeding, and things like that.
That's interesting. So if a company can improve on a molecular drug, but they don't change the molecular substance of the drug.
When it comes to the inactive ingredients.
The inactive ingredients. Okay. So when I look at specific drug classifications, I often see a theme. So phenobarbital, phenobarbital. There's specific maybe prefixes, but mostly suffixes that really kind of designate, or in my mind when I'm studying these drugs, there's a way I can tell a benzo because of a specific suffix. Is that true or did I just create that?
No, that's absolutely true for some drugs. I wish it was true all across the board. There's some classifications of drugs that are not going to follow those naming schemes, but absolutely. And I use this in my own teaching, and I think it's extremely effective. Like you were saying, you have pentobarbital and phenobarbital, and there's mefobarbital and secobarbital, and anything that ends in arbital, you could say is going to be a barbiturate. Mm-hmm. If I start talking to you about butalbital, you'll know what it is.
Yep.
Right? And with benzodiazepines, anything that ends in azolam or azapam. So midazolam, alprazolam, those are going to follow that same scheme. And so you'll know azolam or azapam, it's going to be a benzodiazepine. With some exceptions, some rare exceptions, you're going to find something that may not fit with that, like sodium amytal. Mm-hmm. Doesn't quite sound like barbitol, but it's still a barbiturate.
Going back to kind of the confusion of it, are there any drugs that aren't, you know, treatment for epilepsy that do share suffixes of treatments of epilepsy where it can kind of get confusing?
So, yeah, actually, something like carbamazepine or oxcarbazepine. That's going to make someone who has heard the word benzodiazepine kind of think it might be a benzo. Oxcarbazepine sounds like benzodiazepine, but has a completely different method of action, different classification of drugs, different side effects.
You know, I've done a lot of research on your lectures, which are absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
Viewers at home, if you have not, please check out Jay Jones's lecture material. It's absolutely incredible, super, super informative and just interesting in general. But watching some of your talks, preparing for this podcast, I saw you teach on the therapeutic index. For those who don't know, and review for me what a therapeutic index is, because I think it's so helpful when you're thinking about doses, when you're thinking about efficacy of these drugs. How does a therapeutic index really work, and what can you get out of it by just looking at it?
All right, very good question. So the therapeutic index is basically going to let us know the amount of a drug that needs to be in the system, in the blood serum, to have an effect, and how much of that drug is going to be too much to where the effect starts leading to adverse effects that could range from a little uncomfortable to potentially even fatal. So when we're talking about the therapeutic index, we're talking about dosing and blood levels over time. Okay, so when someone first takes a medication, that medication metabolizes, it gets into their blood, and the levels of that drug in their blood start to increase. Over time, it reaches a peak and it starts to fall down a little bit, and then the patient starts excreting or eliminating the drug, and so it starts falling back down. And this is why a lot of times we got to take these drugs with pretty regimented doses. Like you take one every 24 hours or one every 12 or one every 4 hours, because when you take the next dose, it's as the first dose starts wearing off, as it starts leaving, right? And so your next dose builds it back up in your serum. So the therapeutic index itself can be kind of looked at as just this little range between the what we call the MEC, minimum effective concentration, and the MTC, the minimum toxic concentration. So toxic really just means now it has the potential to start doing harm. So we want the drug to be above the minimum effective concentration because we want it to work. But once it starts going above that minimum toxic concentration, now the risk for adverse effects is going to increase. Something that's always stuck with me from back when I was a student, my pharmacology teacher would always say, every drug has a dark side. Say with this accent, this British infused Jamaican accent. And it was wonderful to hear.
Yeah.
But every drug has a dark side. And you would always remind us of that. And it doesn't matter if you're taking just enough of the drug for it to start working, or if you're taking enough of that drug to become poisonous and toxic to you. Those adverse effects always have a risk of appearing. But once you're over that minimum toxic concentration, then the risk for adverse effects increases, and the risk of more severe adverse effects also increases.
So the idea, the goal is to keep the patient or yourself in this threshold of the golden zone, right? Yeah. And so what you're saying is whenever, and I'll throw a graphic up for the viewers, but you're seeing this curve go in and out of this Goldilocks zone, right? And then you're seeing the next curve kind of intersect when the other curve is coming out. I think it's a really great graphic.
And since every drug is going to be different, it's going to be metabolized different, and then there's also variances from person to person, the therapeutic index of each drug is also going to look different too.
So it changes.
You can basically just look at it as how much you need to have for the good effects versus how much you need to have, or how much will start to cause the really toxic effects.
Yeah.
And then sometimes even drugs will, patients will be given a loading dose of a drug, and that's a much larger dose than what their maintenance dose would be, but it's just enough to put them right where they need to be in that therapeutic index. And then they'll give smaller doses that may not put them there by themselves, but they'll keep them there. So it'll kind of rise and fall a little bit and maintain.
I gave a talk in Asset 2023, I believe, on pharmacology.
Great.
And
talk.
Thank you. Yeah, you were there.
Yeah.
And one of the questions I had was, what are the benefits of a bolus versus just regular administration? Can you go over that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, part of that is like what I was just saying right there. The bolus is a good way to introduce a large enough dose of the drug into the system so that it can get into that therapeutic index. Because sometimes it may not be safe, or it may not be a good idea to give a drug to a patient so they can take home from a pharmacy that has a dose that is high enough to put them in that therapeutic index. Because if they skip a dose and they double up to make up for it, or they accidentally take an extra dose, it might easily put them above the minimum toxic concentration. Some drugs like lithium, which has a very narrow therapeutic index, or phenytoin, narrow therapeutic index, they're going to very easily become toxic. So that bolus is a good way to just get it up in there, and then they can keep up with maintenance doses and just maintain.
So is a bolus administered differently?
Yeah, bolus. Typically, a bolus is administered as a shot, right? So you get a
to get into the blood,
just put it right in there, and it's just one shot. It doesn't have to wait to be metabolized through the GI tract. It just goes right into the bloodstream, and then it can be metabolized from there. So it's kind of like a shortcut.
Going back to that Goldilocks window in the therapeutic index. So if a drug stays in that window, never gets too toxic, does that mean that the drug is going to have no side effects, where you can completely skip all side effects as long as you're in that window?
Every drug always has potential to have a side effect. It just means that that potential is going to be decreased, but it's never zero.
Like you said, every drug has a dark side.
Every drug has a dark side.
Yeah, I think that's important, really. I mean, it's kind of a funny thing to think about, but these medications are serious.
Yeah.
And if people take the wrong dosage, it really emphasizes how important it is to follow the instructions of your physician whenever you're taking these medications. Absolutely. If you think of these drugs as something to be respected and almost even feared, I think any kind of medication should be that way. And if you think every drug has a dark side, instead of maybe making you not want to take the drug, if you respect it enough, it can be life-changing, especially for these people experiencing epilepsy, and it kind of controls that.
I think that's where patient education really comes in. I think if patients are not fully educated on what to expect or what could happen, not just as far as their treatments, but also as far as adverse effects. When it comes to drugs like Keppra, we like Keppra for a lot of reasons. There's very little effect on the EEG and low side effect profile, but there's not zero side effects. So if a parent is told, you know, your kid might be more irritable, they might have some issues where they can't control their temper, or, you know, just behavioral problems, that's something that they should be aware of. Just the same that we might say, well, with this drug, if there's any sign of rash, it can turn into something serious. So, you know, come on into the doctor or tell a doctor something. So even if it's something as subtle as irritability, they should still know, because that might lead to something where if it's not expected, parents don't like it, or even the patient doesn't like it, and they say, I don't want to take it.
Whose responsibility do you think it is for that education? Do you think it's the drug companies? Do you think it's the doctor? Do you think it's the patient? Do you think it's the patient's parent?
That's a really good question, because on the side of personal accountability, a lot of people kind of have the mentality that it's up to you to know what you're taking or know what you're doing. But these are complicated drugs, and there's people who go to school for decades and still don't fully understand all of them. So it's hard to put something like this all on the patient or on the patient's caregivers. So I think it's a team effort. The physician and the techs definitely should communicate and have an understanding of who's going to educate, because we don't want a tech telling things to a patient that a doctor doesn't think is appropriate for that patient to know. Or maybe a tech just doesn't say it right because the tech doesn't have the understanding that the physician has. So if the physicians and the techs both have an understanding of how to educate, what levels each one, the tech or the physician or anyone else, should educate the patient, then I think it's great for everyone to be involved. And even further than that, when the patients go to pick up their prescription, the pharmacist should also have a role in educating the patient. And while I do believe that parents or the patients or the caregivers should take some of the role of making sure they understand what it is they're taking. Not everyone is capable of that. And so we can't put the onus on the patients. Otherwise, we're turning them into a victim.
What you said is great, that last part, because even language barriers. And that is really out of the hands of the doctor, the educator, and the parent or the patient. As a matter of fact, I remember a patient came in, Spanish speaking only, and they were having these issues. And the neurologist asked, "Are you taking your medications?" "Oh, yeah." They had a translator at the time. I think it was a relative. But they were saying, "Yeah, I'm taking my medications. You know, I take them every 1st and 15th or whatever." It was like the first day in the middle of the month. And he was like, "No, this is a daily drug. Yeah. This is a daily administration of your drug therapy. No wonder it's not working."
Yeah.
And so I think that highlights all kinds of barriers that you have to think of